From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, how farm economics work from large-scale growers to smaller producers.
Later, a Milwaukee man publishes the remarkable travel journal his father kept on the trip of a lifetime, 2 months in Europe in 1936.
Over time, it was edited and re-edited and revised, and upon its completion, it occurred to me that this is something that covers so many topics of interest, particularly at during this time in which we live, that it might be worth actually turning it into book form.
And the Wisconsin-based band Dead Horses thinks about living up to the success of their last album.
As we've been working on that material, I've thought about it in comparison to Cartoon Moon, and I guess as an artist, I'm trying not to compare it too much. I think that can be kind of detrimental to the creative process.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tike. We've been talking about agriculture in Wisconsin during our Full Plate series of the past few months, and with much of the harvest yet to come around the state, we're continuing that series for a few more weeks.
Lake Effect contributor Dave Kozlowski is the co-owner of Pinehold Gardens in Oak Creek. His farm includes 40 to 50 different crops on 16 acres. That smaller scale, plus the farm's sales, place it in line with about a third of the commercial farms that operate in the country.
Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski talked with Kozlowski this month about the economics of farming for him and for the larger scale growers in Wisconsin. He says that no matter the size of the farm, growing produce is labor intensive work.
I work probably about 3,000 hours a year, which is more than full time.
Yes.
And most of that time is in the summers. So it's from, say mid-April through mid-October. And then the hours change, largely because it's dark. We are driven by the sunlight, as well as our plants. So it's going to be a lot of handwork. We do have two employees. They're seasonal. And we also have what are called worker shares. I should back up a little bit. Pinehold has a CSA program called Community Supported Agriculture. And it's particularly labor intensive because to meet the demands for that, we have to grow 40 to 50 different kind of vegetables. With the CSA program, there are folks that work for us that are basically paid with food or with a membership to the farm, and they're called worker shares. We have 20 of those, and they work 2 days a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays. They do a big chunk of the harvesting. Without them, it would be impossible for us to do what we do. So they're critically important. Without them, we would have to hire significantly more labor, which would cost us significantly more.
With hiring labor, do farms that mainly have one type of crop and perhaps one major company as their buyer, does that impact the amount of labor they need if it's only one certain type of skill set needed for harvesting this kind of crop? You know, say if someone's doing strictly cabbage in southeastern Wisconsin versus yourself who has all these different vegetables to do.
Mm-hmm. From the farmer's perspective, yes. They can specialize their equipment. They can specialize the way their fields are planted. And the help that is hired knows what they're going to be doing Monday through Friday, 10, 12, 14 hours a day. So you can get very good at it. I've watched the folks south of us in Racine County pick cabbages. They're fast. They're very quick at loading up a truck, faster than I could probably do it, even though I've been doing it for 23 years. That's just something that they do constantly. So if you're specialized, you can do that. The workers themselves, though, however, don't just do cabbages all year long. A lot of these folks move from farm to farm to farm to farm. And so they are specialized in cabbages and picking apples and whatever the case may be, wherever the work is. So it does make a difference if you're just doing a few crops and you can specialize your labor needs and the equipment needed to pick that.
So in general, whether people are farming on your scale or perhaps even bigger acreage, would you say farming is typically not categorized as a major profitable business? I mean, it is a necessity, but when it comes to other businesses of the world, or, you know, you used to be in publishing yourself and things like that. But, you know, it's something that's needed, of course, because we all need to eat.
There's an old joke. There's an old joke. Two farmers meet each other on the road, and one farmer goes, boy, what would I do if I won the he's asked, what would he do if he won the lottery? And he says, well, I'm going to buy a new car and pay off the house and travel. And the other farmer goes, what would you do? And he goes, well, I'll probably continue farming till I lose the money. That's not true.
Right.
Farming is a business. And so you're not in it unless you're making a profit. Farming, however, is a little bit different from other businesses in that we have to deal with variables that most businesses don't. Even in construction, in bad weather, some folks are going to get paid. Construction companies are still going to make money. They'll make up the time. Farmers in bad weather lose money. There's just no way about it. And so we have to deal with the nature as a variable.
Well, how do you plan for that? Say a yearly budget when you're looking ahead, say, okay, well, we think this season will turn out like this. But of course, as you say, you never know.
You never do know. And the budgets are set based on really experience and history. We know by this time in our careers about how much we're going to need to spend on things. We are going to need anywhere from $25,000 to $30,000 to start up the season. Built into that is some money for equipment that we know that may break down, that we may need to replace, things like that. So that's every year. We don't know what the weather's going to bring. This summer, I thought, was going to be an ideal summer for growing. I thought we were going to get rain and it was going to be warm. It's been cool and the rain has stopped. So it's not been what I expected. We look at meteorological and climatological reports, but any meteorologist will tell you their best guess is only good out to 2 or 3 days. So farmers tend to plan like pessimists, but plant like optimists. So we hope for the best and plan for the worst. There's no other way of doing this business except like that. And if you're not doing it that way, then you're going to end up not being profitable, and then you're going to end up not being in a business.
Now, your farm is strictly organic, but for those farms who do need extra costs to pay for chemicals and machinery and all the maintenance involved, how much does that factor into a yearly cost outside of paying for labor? Would you say the majority cost for farmers is just strictly buying seeds and the produce?
I would say, there's economies of scale in everything, right? Mm-hmm. So a small produce farm that's using organic practices is going to have a higher labor cost. A similar-sized farm that isn't organic and can use conventional pesticides and herbicides doesn't need the labor. So far, chemicals are cheaper than hands and labor. So a conventional farm's profit margin is going to be a little higher than an organic farm's profit margin. That's one reason why organic food costs a little more. We were trying to get into that profit margin range that conventional farms can be in because the advantage they have of spraying any number of herbicides or chemicals on the field. Hand weeding is labor intensive. Even cultivating with a tractor is slow and intensive. If you can go through a field and spray glyphosate or something like that, Roundup, boy, you save yourself a lot of hand labor and a lot of costs.
So there's a monetary advantage, but a lot of debate has come up. When it comes to any product or service people are willing to spend money for, you know, what is the price, the ultimate price for that cost? So what do you think the key question or issue that people face, both farmers and consumers, when buying and setting a price for produce, inherent in the practices that are implemented in order to get the produce from the farm to the store?
Yeah. I guess since I'm both a farmer and a consumer, I can see it from both sides. The farmer really has very little leeway unless you are really large and dominate a sort of niche or market. Then you have a little more flexibility maybe in pushing for a better price on contracts and things like that. Most of us, including most dairy farmers and whatnot, we pretty much have to take the price that the market gives us. In the case of, say, dairy, you know, their market prices are set by the Chicago Board of Trade. In the case of produce farmers, particularly who sell direct, our market is really priced according to what people are willing to pay for. So the issue of how much something should cost and what should go into the factoring of that falls more into the hands of the consumer. If what they want is just really cheap food, which, by the way, out of the 83 countries that the USDA monitors, the U.S. has got the cheapest food. And if that's what they want, that's what they will get. If consumers want something different, if they want organic food, if they wanted food that tastes better, if they wanted food that was locally grown, if they wanted food where they knew the farm and the farmer, they will have to seek that out, and farms will do likewise. It's happening in baby steps already, actually. There is a growing interest in people wanting to eat better. It's slow, tiny baby steps. But where I see the effect, really, is on the conventional side. When you look at the trade journals and things for growers of, this is, again, produce, you're seeing them slipping farther and farther away from using just straight-up chemicals, herbicides and pesticides, and going more to the biological uses of things, which is what the organic growers use. They're recognizing that the market is heading towards a little healthier food choices. So I don't set the price. I mean, we know how much we have to make a profit and to stay in business. But that's flexible based on what the consumer's willing to pay. So it's up to them. The ball's in their court.
So if the ball's in their court, but yet you only plant so much per year, isn't there the risk of either overestimating or underestimating what price the consumer's willing
every
to pay?
Every year. Yep.
Another thing that industry, large agribusiness type things that really rely on hundreds and hundreds of migrant workers and is a current debate is that if you increase the labor costs, if you give your workers a better living wage, then the price of food will skyrocket. Is this true, do you think?
Yes and no. Again, we're dealing with economies of scale. If the large California growers were to raise the wage of their workers to $15 an hour, which is reasonable, it would increase the average consumer's food costs, $21 a year. Nothing, basically. That's not quite the same, I think, if you're a smaller farm and you need to hire more workers. That's going to have a bigger impact on your profitability and make it much more difficult to be a business. We pay our workers $10.50 an hour. If we had to pay them $15 an hour, I am not sure that we could stay in the business. So it's an economy of scale thing. It's possible that we could if we express to our people who buy from us that we need to do this and we need to raise our prices. Again, the ball's in their court.
So as you say, what one issue is for, say, a massive agribusiness out in northern Wisconsin is not going to have the same results for all the other farms.
No. And you know, I think this needs to be studied further because I would like to know where the sweet spot is. Where is the spot where if you're doing 40 acres of vegetables that you can afford to hire X number of employees and still make a profit? I know a farmer who is doing 30 acres of produce plus a heck of a lot more sweet corn. They're having a difficult time paying enough labor to make a profit. So I suspect that the amount is higher than that. Maybe it's 80 acres of produce. And again, it depends. You know, a dairy farm is another thing. A fruit orchard is another thing. If you're growing corn and soybean, it's another thing too. So it really depends on the type of farm.
And what do you think is the ultimate question of responsibility for consumers if we want to see farmers be able to maybe not worry so much during the year with profit and scale, but also on the larger agribusiness scale, see workers treated better and practices changed?
Convenience is still the rule of the land right now. They're going to have to, well, I think Houston is an interesting situation here. There was a natural disaster there that has shut down the fourth largest city in the United States. It happens to be Houston, where it's a port and there's a lot of industry down there, so it's going to affect those market sectors. What happens if such a thing happened in California? Or what happens if we happen to be importing a great deal of food now from Canada and Mexico, but increasingly we're importing food from China and India? What happens if there's natural disasters there? The amount of food that we have in the pipeline is 3 days. If there is a cataclysmic something that happens in California or Mexico or Canada or China, we don't have a lot of resiliency in our food system. So that concerns me. And I wonder if we wouldn't be better off, if the consumer wouldn't be better off, if we started thinking more on a regional basis. So one thing they should consider is maybe they should be supporting, you know, regional farms and local farms. Maybe they should be thinking about the quality or the health of their food. So I should hope that eventually consumers would raise a voice and start wanting to see changes in the food system, as I suggested I think might be necessary, and also use their dollars to support the food that they think is accomplishing the goals of a more resilient food system. And perhaps the industry will listen and the market will listen. I think it will. Farmers aren't dumb. They want to make a living. They want to stay in business. And they will do what they need to do that.
All right, Dave. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Dave Kozlowski and his wife Sandy Rodens are owners of Pine Hole Gardens in Oak Creek. Kozlowski spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. You can find all the parts of our Full Plate series at WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break now, and when we return, we'll hear about a travel journal from 1936 and what makes it worth reading today. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Even if you stayed around Wisconsin this summer, the chances are good that there's someone in your social circle who might have made their way to Europe in the past few months.
Well, Americans traveled to Europe in the 1930s as well, but for many who did in those days, it qualified as the trip of a lifetime. That was certainly the case for Frank J. Daly, a 30-year-old schoolteacher from Chicago. Daly spent 2 months in Europe in 1936, a time when the specter of war was beginning to loom.
Daly passed away some time ago, and his trip would have been long forgotten, except that a two-volume journal of his journey survived and was discovered by his son, Milwaukee attorney Frank Daly. And that writing was so vivid enough that Daly thought others might want to read it. And so with the assistance of journalist and editor Kurt Chandler, the book My Trip Abroad, Europe in 1936 was born. Daly and Chandler came to the studio in July. Welcome to you both.
You're welcome, and thank you for having us.
Thanks, Mitch. Good to be here.
Frank Daly, when did you first read your father's travel journal?
Shortly after the time that I discovered it among his belongings after his death in 1997, when we were cleaning out his belongings back in Chicago, and it was contained in these journals which we found, which were sort of at the bottom of a box that had many other mementos in it and some of his writings and other things that we were going through trying to determine what to keep and what not to. And I read hurriedly through it and was astounded because I did not know they existed. Nice thing, it seems to be jiving with what I'd been told as a boy, and then being the extraordinarily efficient and capable and a state administrator, I thought, well, we probably don't need these. Where am I going to put these? So I was thinking about discarding them, and my wife, Julie Ebert, another lawyer from Coralsbury, said, "No, well, you know, this is the kind of thing that you might regret that if you do that. And even though it might be in our basement, that's okay because it's the kind of thing that creates a number of memories and it might be a very valuable memoir someday." And she was absolutely right. So I'm grateful for her insight. And then later had occasion to read a little bit more. And then after my retirement from the active practice of law, I set about the task of trying to dictate these because I was fairly able to read my father's penmanship, which is sort of elegant but not always legible. And the books were not in the best of condition. Some of the pages had been water stained and were sort of loose and falling, but they were all there. And so after a lot of arduous attempts, I was able to get a working draft of a typewritten version of these so that it would be easier to work with. And then over time, it was edited and re-edited and revised. And upon its completion, it occurred to me that this is something that covers so many topics of interest, particularly during this time in which we live, that it might be worth actually turning it into book form. And that's when I talked to Kurt to get his good assistance and advice on that.
Well, and you said you did not know that these journals existed, but at the same time, it sounds like you were very much aware of this trip. This was something that he talked about.
That's correct. He termed it always as the trip of a lifetime, and had planned that trip, astonishingly to me, from the time he was about a 10-year-old boy till he took the trip when he was age 30. And his feeling of joy and his feeling of fulfillment is just reflected all through the pages of the things that he had so long to see, and obviously had done a great deal of research, which astonishes me. I mean, he was a school teacher, but came from a family where he was the only child of nine who actually proceeded to school past the age of 16. It was an Irish working family, and people were supposed to go out and start contributing. His father was not happy with his decision to pursue his education.
Kurt, so Frank Daly brings you this manuscript. You know, it's a journal, so it's not necessarily meant for on the record, you know, public reading. What struck you immediately about it that made it worth, you know, made it compelling and worth your time?
Well, I guess initially it was his keen eye for detail. He really had an eye for even the smallest things. His observations were really spot on, I thought. And they were spot on in the year 1936. So in reading this, you know, 80 years later, I got a real strong sense of history based on his chronicles, his very descriptive chronicles, and that's what pulled me into this journal. At first I thought, okay, well, it's somebody's travel log, but it was far more than that, you know, after I started reading it, and that's what intrigued me.
Well, and I think about, you know, early travel logs, you know, you think of Mark Twain, and you think of some of the classic, you know, Hemingway-esque writers out there. And one of the things that strikes me about this is, you know, this is a travel log written by an ordinary guy, which, you know, there aren't a lot of those out there. How was he even able to make this trip happen? It must have cost a fortune in those days.
It must have, and that's one of the mysteries that I have never quite solved, except that there's mention in the book frequently of a man named William Beale, who was a travel agent, and apparently a friend of my father. I'm not sure how he was a friend all through the time I was a young boy, as a matter of fact. But he somehow must have gotten other kinds of concessions, and which enabled my father to be able to go. It's also clear that my father had been saving for this trip since it was a trip virtually since the time of being a teenager and when he was earning some money. So it was a combination of those. But I agree, I was amazed at the what this must have cost. I can't imagine what it would cost today. It'd be just staggering. The other thing that occurred to me when I was coming back from New York recently in O'Hare Field and watching people pick up their luggage at the baggage claim areas was, how in the world did he pack for 2 months? And when there were suitcases didn't have wheels, they were not lightweight, there were no backpacks, and yet he had a pack extensively because he had all different environments he was going to be in, including formal attire for being on shipboard for parties and dances and plays and whatnot. Obviously, was something that was planned, and I think that this William Beale was no doubt an important influence, both in terms of his anticipation of it, but also in terms of his ability to know what to pack and how to pack and how to travel within Europe.
One thing that he does not seem to have had is a camera. In some ways, this journal really seems like it substitutes for having a camera.
You mentioned that's precisely what I felt as I read it. It was like being in the moment with him. It was being and having gone then and using his book as a guide. Something. What he described was it was a perfect picture of what I was actually looking at. the Colosseum in Rome, all of the places in Paris, the Eiffel Tower, the Sorbonne, the Louvre, Notre Dame, the walk along the Seine with the artists and booksellers, all there when I went there. And just the descriptive talent he had was amazing. His descriptions of the Palace of Versailles, for example, are quite detailed. And when I was there, look, I was just astonished by the minute observations that he would make of the gold in the rooms and of the design of the couches and things like that, so that his book actually painted a picture for the mind when you're reading it.
I think his insatiable curiosity is what drove him here and really compelled him to jot things down in this journal every day. He was very disciplined. And he also had, I think, an incredible insight. I mean, he was sort of charmed by European life. I mean, he had never been abroad, and so the customs and the styles and the way people spoke and dressed were all a fascination to him. And and he was able to just pick little things from his observation, like, for example, he said Italians are much better dancers than the Hollanders or Germans.
So I know some people in Milwaukee who would dissent strongly to that.
So he was very astute about what was going on around him. He was very present.
You know, and there are so many stops along the way, and obviously we can't talk about all of them,
sure.
But I appreciate that you've been bringing some up. In some ways, it almost feels like a Forrest Gump-like trip through Europe. I mean, he had an audience with the Pope.
Right. Yeah, I'm standing right next to him. Unimaginable, and especially in today's times.
Well, and apparently he knew just how to get that.
Well, again,
through
the travel arrangements that Mr. Beale made and introducing him to a priest who was on board the ship who then had the connections with people in the Vatican. And being from Chicago, my father knew how to use political connections.
He's not from that Daley family.
He's
though.
Not, and it's just regrettable. I might have been a mayor if I'd say.
And a fine mayor.
But I think part of it, Mitch, too, is that I think he must have done a lot of preparing for this. I mean, he sort of knew in advance what he wanted to see, sort of what it looked like. And I thought each time I read it, I thought it reflected the feeling that anybody who I think travels to Europe or some other foreign for the first time.
And at the same time, he's seeing these things and he's also experiencing what life is becoming as the Nazis have risen to power in Germany, as the fascists are in power in Italy, and he's able to reflect on what that looks and feels like.
Yes, I thought his comments were very astute, and in particular, there's a few things in there that addresses those questions. And one of them was when he was first docked, the ship was docked off the coast of France while some of its passengers were disembarking. He was standing by the railing observing all this. And he said, you know, there was a gentle wind blowing toward me, which seemed to carry with it the odor of the farms of France. And that also brought me back many years to my pleasant farm vacations in Illinois. A faint suggestion of red in the far western sky caused me to think of the Great War, being World War I, and the fact that the wind I so enjoyed had blown over the graves of millions of dead men buried in Europe. That, to me, was an extraordinary. But then the kicker to that is a prescient comment that says it also suggested the imminence of another great Holocaust brought senselessly because of the selfishness of men and the unwarranted greed for power.
We should note, though, at one point he does write, at a certain point, one becomes satiated and ceases to record impressions. A traveler needs lots of rest because rapidity and number of impressions is a tax on the nervous system.
Indeed it is. And having my travel myself, when I read that, I was relieved because I thought it might be just me in terms of endurance. But and one of those times was when he was in Berlin and he was absolutely overwhelmed by everything is sheer volume of all the things going on. You know, you have the Reichstag and you've got this, and the Olympics are coming there. So he's at the Olympic Stadium and they're having rehearsals and doing, and the Nazis soldiers marched in uniform and he would not stand up. And they came over to him and told him, you must stand up and say, Heil Hitler. And he refused to do that and said, I will only stand up and salute the flag of America. That's a story he told many times that has always resonated with me. And I always thought if he'd done that 3 years later, I would never be here because he would have been immediately executed, I think. But that thing, the thing in Berlin with all of this going on and the overwhelming presence of the Nazis and the swastikas and the parades and the fireworks and all of it was so emotionally and physically taxing that he didn't record those regularly in his diary.
Well, Frank Daly and Kurt Chandler, we are very grateful that you've shared it with us. Thank you both so much.
Mitch, our pleasure. Thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you, Mitch. Good to be here.
Frank Daly's late father, Frank J. Daly, was the author and Kurt Chandler the modern-day editor of My Trip Abroad, Europe in 1936. You can see photographs of Daly's 1936 travel journal at WUWM.com, and our interview first aired in July.
Frank Daly's father was not the only one who saw what was happening in 1930s Europe. Essayist Lauren Fox's grandparents did, too, and immigrated to the United States. It was a time that Fox has thought about a lot recently and reflects on in the September issue of Milwaukee Magazine.
Some years ago, as I was helping my parents clean out their basement, I discovered a small wooden box, inside of which were dozens of letters, written on onion skin paper in fading ink. Letters from my great-grandmother, Frieda Weiss, to my grandmother, Ilse. In 1938, Ilse and her husband and their daughter, my mother, emigrated from Langenlonsheim, Germany, to Milwaukee. My grandfather's best friend, as it happened, was in the SS, and he had warned them, "You have to leave now." The Nazis were going to accuse my grandfather of being a communist and come for him. They managed to get out. The rest of the family stayed behind. From 1938 through 1941, they tried, with the increasing desperation of German Jews on the cusp of World War II, to leave. I could barely decipher a word of the letters, and neither could my mother, who had worked as a German translator. My great-grandmother wrote an old-fashioned German script called Fraktur, which was taught until the early 20th century and briefly resurrected during the Nazi era when it was considered a pure, authentic German script. Very few people can still read it. It looked, to my eyes, like a series of loops and slashes. I was in graduate school at the University of Minnesota when I found the letters, and my search for a translator led me to a German professor there who took a personal interest in my project. Every week, I would go to his office with a few letters, and he would read them out loud, in English, into my little tape recorder. Later, on my own, I would transcribe them. It took us 2 years to get through them all. Professor Weiss, no relation, told me once that he felt like he was getting to know my family. I felt the same way. Through her anxiety and worry, my great-grandmother wrote again and again about how much she missed her granddaughter, but how glad she was that they were gone from Germany, safe. Frieda's letters explained a piece of my own heart to me. In them, I heard all the echoes of enormous love and fear that were handed down to me. The letters became the basis of my master's thesis. I was so immersed in the project that sometimes I would come home at the end of the day and half expect to find a letter from my great-grandmother in my mailbox. June 10, 1938. This morning, we received your dear letter and picture from New York. I'm terribly homesick for my little child. I think that things don't look too good here. October 12, 1939. I hardly sleep anymore, and you, my dear ones, write that you think we will be with you in the spring. There is no possible way of thinking about that. We will sell our house now very soon, and the Fuchses will permit us to stay on in the apartment. I myself am no longer what I used to be. When I finished my thesis, I didn't want to think about what had happened to my family anymore. I had read the story of their futile attempt to escape Nazi Germany slowly over the course of 2 years, and I was exhausted by the end of it. I let go of those letters for a long time. But perhaps not surprisingly, they've come knocking again, demanding my attention. Frieda's words reflect what happens when the hatred that exists in the shadows of a culture is watered and fed, given permission to blossom. The letters illuminate the unraveling of a regular life, the pulsing anxiety of a woman who has said goodbye to her beloved daughter, son-in-law, and granddaughter, and knows that she is in the process of slowly losing everything in a country she thought was her home. We all know how the story ends. But I also know this. I'm here because my grandparents and mother got out of Germany just in time, and because the United States welcomed three refugees to safety.
Lauren Fox is a novelist who lives in Shorewood. Her essay appears in the September issue of Milwaukee Magazine.
We'll take one last break and then catch up with Dead Horses, the Milwaukee band that releases a new single today. Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
¶¶ just want to go where the grass is green in another land and another dream right outside my window.
More of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Type.
And I'm Bonnie North. The Wisconsin band Dead Horses played this song, Kickapoo Creek, the last time they joined us in the studio. That was shortly after the release of their last album, Cartoon Moon. The album garnered national praise, and it earned the band 3 Wisconsin Area Music Industry Awards this spring, including Album of the Year.
It has been a relatively quiet summer for the group, which calls Milwaukee its home after starting in Oshkosh years ago. But that's about to change. They release a single today ahead of another album on the way, and they'll play a show at Turner Hall next Friday before hitting the road on a national tour. So we invited them back to play for us. Singer and guitarist Sarah Voss takes the microphone on behalf of the band today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mitch. Thanks for having us.
So the last time we spoke, Cartoon Moon was just coming out. It was really warmly received, not just in this studio, but in general. What did you take from how that album turned out and how it was received?
I think the fact that we had kind of moved forward with adding percussion to our record and not having fiddle and kind of stepping a little bit further away from the bluegrass scene that we had been in, but still incorporating. There's a lot of mandolin on the record, and it's still got great bluegrass influence. But I think that I was a little bit nervous at the time how it would be received by the people that know us, and very encouraged by the fact that they did receive it well and that we have the type of fan base that is willing to kind of move with us as we progress and try new things.
Well, and I imagine it also has the effect of raising the bar a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and actually we have been working on new material, which we're going to play one of the new songs today. Yeah, as we've been working on that material, I've thought about it in comparison to Cartoon Moon. And I guess as an artist, I'm trying not to compare it too much. I think that can be kind of detrimental to the creative process.
But at some level, I would imagine as artists, you have to, I mean, you know, when you write a new song or record a new song or release a new song or a new album or whatever, it's a little like, you know, putting yourself out there and saying, you know, I hope you still like me.
Absolutely. Yeah, I do feel that way.
I guess it's the direction to go in, though, to keep raising the bar, because otherwise, you know, you have to be strategic and put out, you know, a couple of cruddy albums every once in a while just to ratchet things back a little bit.
It's interesting how that works, though, because, you know, even artists, like even like someone like Paul Simon, you know, like I could disagree with you very much. You could think this was a horrible record of his. I could think it's his best. And I think just being the type of band that releases, that has a long history of recording and releasing material, that's just a goal that I've always had and very happy to move in that direction.
You do, as you say, have this new single, which you're going to play for us in a few minutes, but I guess I wanted to talk a little bit more generally for a few minutes.
Cool.
Yet. This is a pretty, I don't know that I'm making anything up here. This is a bizarre time to be alive.
For everybody, this is true.
How is your creativity affected by the kinds of things that we're all kind of exposed to in 2017?
Very, very much. I think my creativity, I think what I'm putting out is a reflection of both, something that I feel very, like something that's very close to me and something that's happening inside of me that is hard to maybe express. But it's also a reflection of how I see those around me reacting to it. And one of the best parts about being involved in this project has been traveling and talking with people. And we get to talk with all different kinds of people in different social classes and in different scenes. And sometimes it's just even living in Milwaukee, like driving outside of the city, driving through some of the neighborhoods, I feel very influenced by the things that I see on the street. So, I would say, and especially the new material, I think is a little bit more blatant about my opinions, about what we're seeing happening in the world. And, you know, it's something where I hope to not offend anybody, but at the same time, it's authentic and it's true to what I think and how I feel.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's interesting to think about when you're on a stage or even just when someone has one of your albums. I mean, everybody brings their own set of experiences. You have this group of people that might not ever otherwise be together in the same room for any other reason.
Yes, that's very true. And I think generally, a lot of the audiences we're in front of are pretty progressive. Generally, those are the types of people that support the kind of arts that we're involved in, at least at this point. But I know, like, last spring we were on tour with Elephant Revival, and we played in this beautiful theater in Colorado. And we played our set, and then we ran out to sell our merch and stuff. And this woman came up to me, and she totally yelled at me for being political. And I had not said anything very direct. I had mentioned the election because it was only a few months after. And she told me there's no place for that in folk music. And I said to her, you and I have very different opinions about what folk music is. I mean, grassroots movements in this country have largely been moved by folk music. That is what folk music is.
I wonder if
is.
She took Pete Seeger to task.
Yeah, right. I should have suggested a lot of listening for her. But you know what I think it was? I think she felt excluded. And I think she felt like she was probably the only person in the room who didn't agree. And I can certainly sympathize with that. You know?
I know Cartoon Moon spoke pretty strongly to the connection you feel with the land, the natural world. And I wonder if that kind of feeling seems more important than ever.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's similar to writing. Like, my writing process, I'm starting to realize, is really it's a practice, as is for me spending time in nature. It's just something that I do just even – we've been home a little bit more this summer, and even in Milwaukee, just driving out of the city or in the city walking around is just something that feeds me, keeps me healthy.
The trees have no idea who's president or what's
going on.
Or do they,
Mitch? Do they? I don't know.
All right. So what can you tell us about this newest song that is, as we're having this conversation, just about to come out?
Sure. Well, ironically, this is a song that I actually wrote like years ago. So pre-Cartoon Moon, I wrote this, but it was something we had just kind of played and worked on off and on. It always kind of brings me back. You know, songs can remind you of feelings that you've had or places or people or things that you've experienced. And I remember particularly, and I'll still go there in my head when we play this, being somewhere in northern Wisconsin at someone's cabin in the winter and sitting in the living room and kind of, I was still working out this song. And and that's kind of the sentiment, I suppose.
It sounds like, you know, not being a musician, you sort of bring to mind, it must almost be like looking at old photo albums for you.
Absolutely. That's very true.
So this is called Turntable?
Yep. Should we play it?
Absolutely.
All right, let's do it. In the arms of a lover, in the arms of your son, do you lay your breath heavy or not anyone? Won't you sit for a while, won't you rest yourself? You know it ain't such a shame to have lost yourself. You know it ain't such a shame to have lost yourself. Three years and a bottle of cheap red wine. All my sacred sins and all your dirty lies. So
trees stretch and wrap themselves around you, and they fill you up till you don't know what to do. On a winter's night when everything is new, on a winter's night when everything is new.
Hear the sustain. Dead Horses with Turntable in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us in, Mitch.
You know, I don't know what it is, but I think you must have some secret key that makes me feel good about life.
Oh, that's awesome to hear.
Do I understand correctly, you're releasing this on vinyl?
Correct. Yeah,
which makes sense given the subject matter.
Turntable, yeah, and it's a 45 actually, which is pretty cool too. So it'll have this song, and then we went and recorded a B-side song for it as well, and it's a song called Water, which we released like years and years ago that we kind of revamped and kind of did a new way. So.
Well, I was thinking about this because, this is the A side, and there are not a lot of bands out there that are thinking in terms of A sides and B sides anymore.
Yeah, you'd be surprised, though. It's definitely kind of come back into play for a lot of bands, and you're recording on tape or you're going through a tape player, but it's still being digitalized. But there is this awesome lush sound that comes with that.
I was going to ask if there was something really, if you really enjoyed something about being analog in a more digital world.
It's more than just ones and zeros, you know. It's we joke about other things being analog too. Like, I don't know, whenever something is more like true to form, I think we call it analog. But
what brings you the most joy about your life and music right now?
Ooh, Mitch, your questions are great. I've been looking forward to talking with you. What brings me the most joy about actually playing, about being my life with music?
Yeah.
Playing music, number one, for sure. I would also say being a part of a project where I'm working with other people, with my bandmates, with our manager, with our booking agents, publicists. Like, it's pretty neat that it's a team effort and something I think that is fulfilling. It's like something I think I knew all along that I wanted to be a part of something like that. The traveling is also way up there on the list. Getting to see parts of the country, and we're still driving everywhere. So when we go coast to coast, you know, in a 2-month period, we're literally seeing a lot. And with the traveling also, the people, of course, it's such a wonderful education. And I feel just very blessed to have been able to do it and to keep doing it.
What do you think you absorb during that connective tissue, the time between, you know, you leave Milwaukee and you get to Fargo or wherever?
Well, not much on that drive, Mitch.
A lot of dirt.
Yeah. I don't know, you know, and I love just looking out the window. And we all usually just put earbuds in and either sometimes we'll watch Fargo, the show Fargo, we've watched a lot of that, or listen to music and just stare out the window. And I think it's kind of a meditative time. As well as sometimes having bonding moments where we're just talking about stuff.
It's cool when you can be an adult and really look forward to the road trip that
way.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I want to go back to the song you just played for a minute because you had said something while you were warming up that I thought was a throwaway line, and and I was willing to laugh it off. There was a reference you made to it being almost like rapping.
Yeah.
And actually, I sat there and listened to it, and I said, I could buy that, actually.
Yeah. You could turn it into the hip. I'll let you do the hip hop version, Mitch.
We need our turntable for that, though.
Yeah, exactly. Even perfect. Yeah, or even better. I think the rhythm when I composed it was pretty different. It was a little more folksy and slower. But as it progressed with the band and as we collaborated, especially adding drums, I think the tempo picked up. And then I remember approaching it at that point, like, if we do it that too much faster, I really will be rapping. So I think where we found it was a happy medium of where it's kind of close to that, where I am, it's kind of a mouthful, but it's fun to do. And it has like emphasis on certain syllables. I think Ryan Adams does that a lot in his songs, where I've tried to cover them and he's singing so fast, but it's pretty admirable. It's pretty cool, I think.
So you said, that was a song you wrote a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
The B-side, Water, is also one of your older songs. Do you feel like you now have this freedom with where you are to go back and revisit the warehouse, if you will?
Yeah. And I think we've always, it's interesting because I do write a lot, and I'd say the majority of the songs I write don't really go anywhere. And then it's interesting to see, though, how some of the songs will stick around. And 3 years later, I'll still be kind of doodling around with this song. So that's kind of cool. As far as bringing back songs, we've always talked about even like doing like an EP where we reinvent songs. And I think we're not quite comfortable. Like, we haven't been around quite long enough maybe to do that. But the song Water, which is going to be the B-side on this 45, is one that we have continued to play live, yet we don't have it really out on a record that we're currently selling. So this was just kind of a great opportunity to put that out.
So do you have a turntable?
Yeah, of course, Mitch.
Well, so, okay. So the original question I was going to ask, though, is your record collection.
Mm-hmm.
When you are in need of a fix, what is the record you go to most often?
Nick Drake. Nick Drake is kind of my go-to home, you know, record that I'll pull out. But there's a few others. Paul Simon, Graceland. Big fan of that, too.
Much different sounding records.
Yeah, that's true. Townes Van Sant is also one of my favorites to listen to on vinyl.
Well, Sarah and the rest of you, thank you all so much. Best of luck. Congratulations on the new single. And come back and see us again soon.
Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you. And I don't know how I got to be lost inside the steep blue sea.
Dead Horses playing Water. That's the flip side to their single Turntable, which comes out today. They'll play shows this Saturday night in Stoughton and next Friday night at Turner Hall before hitting the road out of Wisconsin for a while. Our studio session was engineered by Jason Reavy. And that is the Wednesday edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for listening today. Please be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.
Oh.